privilege for me to be able to present to you Dr. Harold S. Slusher. He's one of the most impressive speakers that I've heard, and his subject matter is a tremendous blessing in view of the fact that a man of his authority speaks in support of our Christian faith. Dr. Harold Slusher, though a scientist, is a dedicated Christian, and we rejoice in this. He is professor of geophysics and astronomy at the University of Texas at El Paso. He has an enviable record for preparing students in the geophysical field. His students are eagerly sought after in oil, gas, and mining industries. He is an outspoken creationist and one of the most effective in convincing young men of science of the truth of the biblical account. He is director of the Kidd Memorial Seismic Observatory at El Paso. His special interest is solar system astrophysics. During these sessions, he will be speaking to us on some of these scientific problems and especially relating this wealth of knowledge to the subject of a young universe in evidence of God's creative activity. Dr. Slusher, we welcome you to this lectern and to this conference. You come and speak, and no limitations upon you.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed my stay so far in Birmingham. I've been entertained so well, and I certainly enjoyed the fellowship with Dr. Griswold. As a matter of fact, I've learned a great deal myself in talking with him. In regard to this biology book, I'm a physicist, not a biologist, but the Creation Research Society, particularly Dr. Tom Barnes, who was the chairman of the textbook committee, wanted it read and gone over by somebody who wasn't a biologist, since biologists and physicists and engineers and so forth who compose the Creation Research Society, they think a little bit differently, and they write somewhat differently, and they look at things somewhat differently. And so, to use the term, they sort of wanted the devil's advocate to be one of the editors and do some reading in regard to the thing. When it was brought up in the meeting of the Creation Research Society, I could tell the biologists were rather surprised at what in the world the physicist doing, being proposed as one of the editors to this book. Dr. Moore, the other editor, is a biologist at Michigan State University. And Dr. Barnes, being rather skillful in these matters, he pushed the boat through before the biologists ever woke up to what was exactly happening, and they were stuck with me as an editor without maybe really wanting me as an editor in regard to these matters. But the people who wrote the book, the biologists mainly, I did a little bit of writing in it. I didn't like the introduction to it, and I wrote a few things in the introduction, and they let it stand. And I didn't like some of the geology parts in it, and did a little bit of editing here and there. But mainly the book was written by a number of biologists that are associated with the Creation Research Society, and I believe they did an excellent job. And as Dr. Griswold has mentioned, it's selling very well, and Bondervan is very happy, and they're into the second printing on it, and this is fine. I hope it continues, and perhaps do a lot of good. There are very few books written as textbooks that are free of evolution. As a matter of fact, as far as biology textbooks are concerned, this is the only one I know of. Dr. Tinkle, a long, long time ago, wrote one for Zondervan, but that's been out of print for decades, and this is the first one, I think. And there are plans for writing some other books in this matter. Well, today, I want to get right into the scientific aspects of creationism and the ideas of evolution. Yesterday, at a number of places, three places, I talked about the philosophical aspects and the religious aspects of this matter. There would be no consideration of evolution probably as a real doctrine today unless there were the scientific aspect of it. People, this idea of evolution is put forth in the name of science, and with all of the authority of science. And people today worship that the sacred cow of science. And if a scientist says something, they seem to think this must be the truth in regard to all these matters. There, of course, can be nothing wrong. If they say it, they're always honest, they figure. They suggest that scientists are just like everybody else, and they say all sorts of things, but they don't know what they're talking about many times. And scientists have a great love for getting out of their own field and discussing things. Scientists consider themselves really the saviors of the world many times, and they love to get onto matters that they don't know much about, and I'm probably guilty of that myself many times. But if something is put forth in the name of science, with all of the authority of science to back it, it is generally accepted. And certainly the ideas of evolution, I think, are just about worldwide accepted. There are pockets of resistance here and there, like here, for instance. And there are people who don't believe it. There are scientists who don't believe it. But yet the majority of people in the scientific field do accept it, not because they've really examined it very carefully at all. Most scientists have never even bothered themselves to take a look at it. I dare say that you'll find very few biology students who have ever read The Origin of Species by Darwin. Maybe they read the first 25 pages or the first 50 pages. It's not easy reading, and it's not interesting reading either, as a matter of fact. And it gets kind of dry and kind of boring as you go along, and I dare say there are very few people who've actually read The Origin of Species today, The Origin of Species by Darwin. And certainly, most biologists haven't spent a great deal of time reading it, but it is accepted. People have a tendency to accept what their professors say in their schools. They have a tendency, professors themselves are bad this way, they have a tendency to listen to their professors, and then instead of doing original thinking themselves, they pass on what they picked up, and it goes on and on and on, and seldom do you find really original thinking, even among college professors, for that matter. A lot that comes out as research is not really good research. A lot that comes out as research is not original. A lot that comes out as research and papers that are written by the dozens are written many times to get raises and to get promotions, because these college administrators have this philosophy, which is a squirrel-headed philosophy, publish or perish. Or, you know, get the papers printed or you're out of business. You have to remain an assistant professor, an associate professor, an instructor, unless you're getting many things out. And, of course, the people get rewards for publishing. I think that probably a good trend that ought to be started in colleges and universities is to give a reward if they quit publishing so much and getting a lot of this that really amounts to junk and not much else in scientific journals. There are a lot of things that pass as research that's not really research at all, but it's just an attempt to get something in print, and you can say then to the dean, well, I got a paper published this year, and that means something to deans and presidents of colleges. But anyhow, this idea of evolution is put forth in the name of science and with all of the authority of science behind it. And therefore, with an authority like that, it is nearly unresistible, so to speak. But I think that there are fatal flaws in it, fatal weaknesses. There are fallacies in it, there are errors in it, and it finds itself in conflict with very important and definite laws in physics. And this morning, what I'm going to deal with mainly is the second law of thermodynamics, which, in my opinion, strikes the death knell of the ideas of evolution, the idea that innate matter, out of innate matter, you can get animate matter. Out of some kind of fortuitous mixture of chemical elements and energy, that you can get life coming out of it, and that this matter has inherent in it the properties of organization, and that gradually over eons and eons of time, that you'll get more complicated systems out of what is referred to as simple systems. I want to examine this second law of thermodynamics very carefully. When I was first really looking into this question of evolution, not knowing much about it, and in those days it being practically impossible to find any books written in opposition to it, when I first heard of it, I went to the University of Tennessee Library, where I was a student, to try to see if there were any books that took a position in opposition to the ideas of evolution. And I couldn't find a single book in the whole library that took the opposite position. And I didn't run into anything in opposition to the ideas of evolution until a few years later. I was at the State University of Iowa one summer taking a course in galactic astronomy, and just happened to run into a Chinese student who had a book written by an English surgeon, A. Rendell Short, first book I'd seen anywhere that said anything contrary to the ideas of evolution. Well, things have changed somewhat, and there are writings today in opposition to it. I was one day over at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and happened to run on a book written by a physicist at McGill University, and just started leafing through this book. And this physicist talked about the second law of thermodynamics. And he showed how the second law of thermodynamics ran counter to the teachings of the evolutionists, and how the second law of thermodynamics says that nature itself, matter itself, or systems themselves tend to go from a state, some state, to a state of disorder, or more and more disorder, as time goes on. I've tried to find that book over the years. I put the book back on the shelf. I just happened to read some, be sitting there in the library, and went back later on and could never find that book again. Either I misplaced it there, or somebody put it somewhere, and I could never find that book. And I cannot remember now the name of that physicist, but I have always been grateful to what he had to say, and whoever the man was that wrote that book, because still, and that book was written a long time ago, it is the best argument I've ever seen from a scientific aspect against these ideas of evolution. I can hardly see how the evolutionist can wiggle himself around the second law of thermodynamics. And of course, he really doesn't. What he ends up doing is merely facing the problem, closing his eyes, and going right on, and paying no attention, of course, to the second law of thermodynamics. You can hardly find a biologist who even knows what the second law of thermodynamics is, for that matter. And I'm not speaking in any hateful way. Happens to be the truth in the matter. You can hardly find a geologist who even knows what the second law of thermodynamics is. I mentioned it in a talk in front of some biology students at the University of Texas at El Paso, and they thought I meant the first law of thermodynamics, which is the conservation of energy law. And they started telling me about the energy cycle in the human body. Well, that's not the second law of thermodynamics, of course, at all. But there's a great deal of ignorance in regard to physics. People want to apply physics to life. They want to apply physics to this whole thing. But you have to be careful in your applications of these things. And you have to know what you're doing. Better not start applying if you don't know what the thing really is that you're trying to apply. There is always this attempt, of course, to dress things up in the name of physics because it looks good. You know, precise, exact, experimental, and all that business, and that sounds good, and gives something a reputation that it doesn't really have, perhaps. Well, I want to define evolution this morning. I want to show you some things that indicate what the evolutionist believes in regard to producing order, and then I want to look into this matter of the second law of thermodynamics, and I'm going to talk about that only this morning because it'll take all the time just to do that. This is an involved thing, very simple concept, but still it is involved. We'll have to think a little bit on it, and I'll need all the time this morning just to talk about that. I could talk about it all day, for that matter. I don't know whether I can keep talking that long, but there's enough to say about it. I might not know everything to say about it that long, but yet it's a subject that is very involved, and you can take courses dealing just with the second law of thermodynamics itself for a semester in physics departments. But evolution is defined in its broadest sense as the theory that all things have been derived by gradual modification through natural processes from previous materials. All forms of life developed from simpler forms. Life itself spontaneously came into existence through a complex organization of previously non-living chemical molecules. Even molecular and atomic structure supposedly has come from some simpler form of matter, whatever that form of matter would be. Nobody has the slightest idea. The universe, the highly organized form of the universe, supposedly came about from a disordered state, came about by an evolutionary process. The astronomer for a long time didn't talk so much about these ideas of evolution, but when he began to see how well the geologists appeared to be doing in this slow progression of changes and the formation of the Earth, and then the biologists in talking about life coming into existence and the development of the various plants and animals leading to the world as we see it today, the astronomers decided to get in on this thing too, and they talk about, of course, the evolution of the universe. Now, there, of course, that word evolution, everybody says, well, you're being unfair using that term. Evolution strictly means change. Well, obviously, change takes place. But as the biologist and the evolutionist himself uses the term, he means a lot more than just ordinary change. When you've got him where it hurts, he switches to saying, all I mean is change. Huh. Not what all he means at all. When he's winning the battle, he figures he's, of course, very bold in what he means by evolution, namely the change of one form into some other form that is basically different. Then he switches to what he really, how he uses the term, continually. When he's on the losing end, he says, well, don't you believe in change? Obviously, that takes place around us. Well, obviously, it does. And I do believe in change. And the Bible does not teach any fixity within kinds, but does teach what? That there are basic kinds, and there are no movement over those boundaries that separate those kinds. So within the kinds, the scriptures have never taught that everything is fixed and there are no changes. Well, look how many types of dogs there are, cats, and all sorts of things. But yet the Bible does teach that there are definitely well-defined boundaries that do exist between the different kinds. And this seems to be rather obvious in when you look at the biological world, that this is true. Austin Clark at the Smithsonian Institute, in his studies of the past, he said there are definite boundaries that seem to lie between different groups of animals, and there is no crossing over these boundaries. And this is exactly what seems to be the case. When you take a look at the fossils, for instance, you do not find intermediate forms between one basic type and some other basic type. Of course, the geologists have talked about these things as missing links or missing fossil forms between one type and another type. But they're, of course, the term missing means they've never been found. They're still missing. Darwin, in 1859, said that the geological record didn't back up his ideas at that time. But he said, give a while, and these geologists will get this thing straightened out, and they'll be able to show the tree of life in the crustal rocks of the earth. Well, in 1959, which was the Darwinian centennial, it was pointed out that W.R. Thompson, head of botanical studies in Canada for the Canadian government, is pointed out by Thompson that the record is more discontinuous, the fossil record is more discontinuous now as a result of 100 years worth of studying and digging around in the rocks. There are more discontinuities and greater discontinuities than anybody realized in 1859. And this is exactly the situation. You don't have these intermediate forms. You have sudden and discontinuous changes, which is what you would expect, really, when you look at how fossils were probably formed and what was involved in this whole thing. You do not find the tree of life in the earth at all. Those links that were missing in Darwin's days are still missing, and I guess you could say, I don't know whether this would be a good way to put it, but more missing than ever in the whole matter. And, of course, geologists deny this, although they admit they're still missing, but they say they were there. I remember speaking at a meeting on the campus, and I pointed this out. The geologists took this thing on faith, this tree of life, that if you couldn't produce a continuous tree, if you could just draw a branch here and a branch there and a little peck of bark here and there and a little bit of the trunk, but you could never put this thing together, you ought to ask an evolutionist sometime to really draw you one of these trees, just showing this thing. There's so many things missing that there's hardly anything of the tree there. As a matter of fact, certainly not connected in any way. I pointed out, and there were some geologists in the audience, that they were taking this thing on faith. And it became a religion then with them, and not a scientific hypothesis. If continually you accept something on faith, and you can't back yourself up with the scientific evidence, and you can't put your finger on those links, so to speak, well, then you have something that it really is a faith. Well, when it was over, the question and answer session started, and I could tell one geologist was red in the face and kind of mad while I was talking. I figured the fun was really coming in a little bit, and it is. He got up. He was very angry with what I had said, and he said I hadn't told the straight of things. Didn't exactly say I lied, but the equivalent of it. And he said that I was wrong in saying they take these things on faith. So I asked him the question. I said, have you found these links that you're talking about in the intermediate forms? I said, that's where I said you were taking things on faith. He said, but no. I said, how do you know they existed in the first place if you cannot produce any of them at all? I said, that's a matter of faith. And as simple as everything, if you can't produce the thing that you believe in, but yet you say it did exist, then you're taking it on faith that it did exist. He said, no, you don't understand. He said, they did exist. They just got eroded away. And, of course, we went around and around. I said, how, then, do you know they existed if you haven't found any of them? How do you know they eroded away in the first place? Well, then he repeated what he had said. You don't understand, he said. They were there, and they were just eroded away, but they're not found. Well, that is, of course, it's obvious. That's a matter of faith. Finally, the moderator decided to call a halt to things, so let's have the next question on the matter. But I should think anybody with an elementary knowledge of freshman mathematics would know that's taking something on faith if you can't produce the thing you say you believe in. But anyhow, the evolutionist says the solar system came into existence by slow processes in which you took a gas in a very disordered state, say a hydrogen dust cloud, and due to gravitational collapse and various other agencies, you got something as complicated as the solar system coming out of it. You've got something as complicated as a comet. A comet is a complicated thing, though compared to a planet, it's not very complicated. But a comet is a complicated thing. You've got meteorites, called meteoroids, while they're in space, traveling in well-defined orbits. You've got a sun that is extremely complicated, generating energy. You generate quite a great deal of energy. Very complicated thing a star is. Why, it'd be much easier to talk about the creation of the universe if you didn't even have to deal with stars. They're such complicated things. A star is the most complicated thing you can imagine. And astronomers really know very little about stars because you can only see directly the surface of a star. And you have to make a lot of guesses in regard to what the star is really like on the inside. But then you've got a thing as complicated as a planet. And you've got things as complicated as life. What we see today, which is extremely complicated and complex. Well, supposedly, all of this came about by chance variation over eons and eons and eons of time. The evolutionist demands huge quantities of time because he thinks everything happens, so to speak, by accident. Although some evolutionists have begun to talk about order being innate in matter because they've run into so many difficulties on this chance variation that it's beginning to become unpalatable to them. And so they talk about matter having the properties of self-ordering in it. Well, this is not the case. It just goes completely in violation of the second law of thermodynamics, which I'll be trying to explain as to what it says in just a few minutes. The evolutionist says that intelligence developed from non-intelligent matter, that morality was evolved from non-moral processes, that love and other emotional qualities came out of unfeeling chemicals, that infinitely complex structures arose from simple beginnings, and that spiritual consciousness itself began out of inert molecules. The evolutionist assumes then that purely by chance you can get all of these complications, and to say the least those things are complicated, you can get all of this out of it. There are seven assumptions, and I want to mention these assumptions associated with the ideas of evolution. The reason I want to mention them is to show you that the evolutionist believes there's a progression from something very simple, which means disordered in physics. This is what, when the physicist says something is simple, he doesn't use that term like it's ordinarily used. He means that you have a system in which there is very little order in it. And when he talks about it being complex, he means that there is a great deal of order. Now, to us, when we use the term simple and complex, we think of something that's what? Highly ordered as being something that is rather simple. Because something that's in a very ordered state, you can understand easier ordinarily than something that's in a disordered or mixed up state. But the physicist uses the terms in reverse of the way they're commonly used. And if he says, when we say something is complex or complicated, we mean it's what? All mixed up? We don't get much understanding out of the thing at all. So you want to remember, the physicist means when it's simple, that it's highly disordered. When it is complex, he means that it is highly ordered. And I'll use the terms, of course, as the physicist does, and as the evolutionist uses the terms, he uses them in the same way. Well, the evolutionist assumes that non-living things gave rise to living material or spontaneous generation. Now, certainly, that's going from what? A disordered state to a highly ordered state, because life, and what is involved in it, is highly complicated, and not just a mixture of chemicals, just any kind of an amount of energy. For life itself to exist, even when you have life, you must have what? Just as a child, when it's born, has to have care for it right then and a cradle, so to speak. Well, life itself, when it came into existence, had to have the forms already prepared that were complicated around it to maintain this life. The evolutionist, he makes things, of course, extremely simple, that you sort of get a speck of life in a very inhospitable environment, and somehow the thing will survive. It takes extremely good conditions around it for life even to survive in a situation. So it's a lot more complicated than it is made to appear. They assume, second, that spontaneous generation occurred only once. That's handy. Of course, to let it occur only once. That's a violation, though, of the ideas that Louis Pasteur put forth in regard to spontaneous generation before that. But these people are trying to explain things on a naturalistic basis. And if they're going to explain them on that way, you can't have a violation of your rules or your laws, but yet they start with a violation of it. Now, if you're going to play the game of science, you have to stick with it that way. You can't mix this thing up and say, well, I'm going to be a scientist here for a part of a while, then I'm going to let the rules drop down. I'm going to change them as I'm running the touchdown. I'm going to run it in the direction that's closest to me. But then after I've run it, I'm going to put the rules back in and say I did all of this in a scientific manner. This is exactly what is involved here. There's a lot of calling on things that have nothing to do with science, a lot of assumptions that are unprovable in the first place by the very nature of them. And yet at the end of all this, we say we've proved it. The evolution says I've proved it scientifically. You can't assume the thing you're trying to prove. You want to remember this. You can't assume that the fossils prove evolution and then turn right around and say, I've used the fossils and they show an evolutionary process. You can't start out by assuming the thing you're trying to prove and then say, I've proved it. Therefore, I've proved it. The evolution starts out by saying what? That simple fossils, you know, very simple organisms, are the oldest and the beginning. And the complicated ones at the end of the chain. Then he goes out and looks at the earth, finds simple ones in what is referred to as the Cambrian, finds more complicated ones up in the Mississippi and Pennsylvania, right down the line, tertiary and so forth, and then says, I've proved it. Well, it's assumed the thing you're trying to prove to start with there. You can't, that doesn't work. I'd mark a student wrong in mathematics if he ever tried that, a trick like that, and any self-respecting mathematician or physicist would say, that's just circular reasoning. But as Dr. Griswold mentioned, that team doesn't like to mention circular reasoning too much. It's embarrassing in science. Astronomers are guilty of circular reasoning, too. There's a lot of things that are involved in circular reasoning. Nobody likes to admit it. For instance, in trying to get the surface temperature of the sun, the astronomer says the sun is a black body radiator. And if it's a black body radiator, I can use the Stefan-Boltzmann law to derive the surface temperature of the sun. Because the Stefan-Boltzmann law says if you can measure the amount of energy coming out of a square centimeter of surface area of the sun in 1 second, that's equal to some proportionality constant times the surface temperature of the sun raised to the fourth power. So we can measure Q, that's the energy coming out per second per square centimeter, we can get T, the surface temperature of the sun. But that only applies to a radiator that is a special kind of a radiator, one that's called a black body radiator. I can't use Stefan-Boltzmann law if it's not a black body radiator. Well, you can measure Q very easily. And all I have to do is put it right in the equation, and out comes T, 6,000 degrees Kelvin. I did that 2 weeks ago for my students. Tonight, they're going to miss me. They're taking a test tonight. I left the test in my place for tonight, and they're one of the things they're going to have to do is derive the surface temperature of the sun. The temperature right at the base of the photosphere, the atmosphere, which is the atmosphere of the sun. They'll have fun tonight. I didn't know, I told my students that I wasn't sure what time I would be back, either Tuesday night or Wednesday morning. And if I got in late Wednesday morning, they only had to wait for me 15 minutes just in case my flight from Dallas was running late. And I said, I think I'll be here, though. And I was curious, they started talking a little bit then, and I felt like Professor Fumble did in a cartoon. Strip that appeared in the Tulsa Tribune used to appear in it. Professor Fumble got sick one day, and he called his secretary to tell his students that he's sick and wouldn't be in today. And he said, what did they say when you told them? She said, I couldn't hear so much wild cheering. Well, I sort of felt like Professor Fumble. My students, I said that I might not make it in for my Wednesday class at 9 o'clock, and I was hoping there'd be expressions of regret, but I couldn't see any for all the wild cheering that was going on. And they heard I might not make it back in time for that first class. Well, they got a surprise. I got a Tuesday night. Tuesday afternoon flight, and they'll be there. They'll be surprised when they see me. I think they were counting on it. They had some tough problems to hand in Wednesday morning. They'll really be sad to see me back. But anyhow, this surface temperature of the sun can be derived in that fashion. But we don't know whether the sun is a black body radiator or not. We are assuming that it's a black body. We're getting the surface temperature of the sun, and then we turn right around and say the sun is a black body radiator, and here's its temperature. Well, this is a bit of circular reasoning, too. You've assumed T,
to get the surface temperature, you've assumed that it's a black body radiator. Then you turn around, well, here's the temperature of it. It must be a black body radiator. Well, that's just working around and around, of course, in a circle. There are some other lines of evidence, though, that seem to suggest that it is a black body radiator. But in the direct use of the Stefan-Boltzmann law, there is some circular reasoning involved in it. Well, let me finish these assumptions here right quickly, or I'm going to spend all my time on something else again. I'm the worst to stay on points that are not so important, and I should be on other things. Well, they assume that viruses, bacteria, plants, and animals are all interrelated. Protozoa, one-celled organisms, gave rise to the metazoa, many cells. Various invertebrate phyla are interrelated. Within the vertebrates, the invertebrates gave rise to the vertebrates. And the seventh assumption, within the vertebrates, the fish gave rise to the amphibia to the reptiles, and the reptiles to the birds and mammals. The modern amphibia and reptiles then had a common ancestral stock, and so on. Now, these seven assumptions are, of course, by their nature, not capable of experimental verification. But, as I was trying to point out, they indicate a movement from something what the physicists call simple to something that is complicated or complex. Now, there's some things you need to remember before I get started here. Students, of course, pay a lot of attention to what is said in the name of science. Some people do, all people do, for that matter, apparently. And there's sort of a diet in universities from which a student would learn, of course, to have faith and to quote authorities when he is in doubt. In doubt about something, just quote Dr. So-and-so in regard to the matter, and that's good enough. Intelligent understanding, I have found in many cases, is the last thing that is really required in a university. I shouldn't be speaking, I'm liable to get kicked out of the union on these things, but nonetheless happens to be true. Intelligent understanding is really the last thing that's required many times. Opinion. Students sometimes to turn out to be just opinion swallowers. That's a shame, of course, if a fellow spends all his money to go through 4 years, turns out mainly to be an opinion swallowing grub, so to speak. That's tragic, after spending all that money. It's mighty expensive to go to college. And money doesn't grow on trees, though some people seem to think so. He swallows opinions. He has faith in theories that he only dimly follows. Faith and opinions that are just very dim and hazy in his mind, and he'll call upon various authorities to support what he does not understand. He says he thinks scientifically, but really, he says he thinks scientifically and despises dogma, but he doesn't really. He does not think scientifically, and he accepts dogmas advanced in the name of science. It seems that people enjoy words that have sort of a pseudo-scientific sound. There's a tendency to become hypnotized by words, and it's always been one of humanity's greatest failings. And there are many people today who never pause to think whether an alleged explanation increases their understanding of nature or whether its whole appeal is in long, well-sounding pseudo-scientific words. So, you check what I say as well as what anybody else says. That's a wise thing to do, and see if it makes sense, and see if it has the element of truth in it. Well, this morning, then, I want to deal with what is referred to as the second law of thermodynamics, and I want to talk this over with you very carefully, because I think it has a great deal of importance in this whole matter. I want to do this thoroughly. It's a complicated thing in some ways. I want to do it rather thoroughly, or try to at least, and so I want to take the whole time this morning. Here I've used up a lot of it already, but I want to talk about this idea very carefully. I want to explain a little bit of the historical background of the ideas of entropy and the second law of thermodynamics. Then I want to try to give you an understanding as to what it actually means and what the conclusions of it are and how it is applied. Well, back in the 1700s, when the supposed industrial revolution was taking place, people were building steam engines, of course, to run mechanical devices and factories, factories dealing with weaving and things of that nature. A French engineer by the name of Sadi Carnot was interested in studying these engines. They found out or noticed some very interesting things, namely that you could convert mechanical energy completely into heat energy. For instance, if a fellow is running along the gym floor playing basketball and slides down, People, while he's running, he possesses a kind of energy called kinetic energy, energy of motion. When he slides down, you know what happens. Certainly you fellows know what happens. When you slide down, you get a good burn right on your leg, and you finally come to a stop. All of that kinetic energy got converted into what is referred to as thermal or heat energy. A fellow gets a blister on his leg. The blister comes because of what? Well, he gets his leg skinned some too, but he gets burned because of conversion of mechanical energy into heat energy and gets his leg burned. If you fell to the gym floor, you'd find his temperature was raised slightly also, by the way, in the sliding. But the engineers in those days noticed that you could convert what is called mechanical energy into heat energy very efficiently. But you see, the thing they were wanting to do was to convert heat energy, though, into mechanical energy. Because steam engines were being built in those days. There was water available in England particularly and other European countries. Plenty fuel available. And so the idea was to build steam engines to run mechanical devices in factories to do weaving and all sorts of things. And so the interest in those days was not in the conversion of mechanical energy into heat energy, but the conversion of heat energy into mechanical energy. Well, they kept noticing something very peculiar. Every time, no matter how well they built those engines, they found that they never could convert that heat energy 100% into mechanical energy. And they found that there was never a complete conversion. Even though you burn the fuel, you have a certain amount of fuel there, a certain amount of heat energy in it, you could never get all of that heat energy converted into mechanical energy. And Carnot studied this in particular, and nobody understood why in the world, since it worked so beautifully to go from mechanical energy to heat energy, why you couldn't go from heat energy into mechanical energy with a 100% conversion, even though you built those steam engines with the greatest efficiency that you could possibly come up with in your design. Always, there was not a complete conversion of heat energy into mechanical energy. And Carnot and the other engineers in those days, in their studies, found that there was always what you would call a loss of energy in the conversion. Now, it wasn't a loss of energy into friction and things like that. There just wasn't the conversion of that heat energy into mechanical energy. Just wasn't a complete conversion. And they found that the amount that you didn't get converted, you know, that went into mechanical energy, depended on the amount of energy in the steam itself and the temperature difference between the steam and the other parts of the system that the steam went to run. And they were able to work out a little empirical formula that would tell them every time for a particular amount of energy that you had available and a particular difference of temperature between your energy source and your surroundings, they could tell you how much you weren't going to get out of that. And in those days, the engineers just named that something, and they called it entropy. And nobody knew why in the world this was taking place. The engineers didn't have the slightest idea, but engineers are great for finding something that'll work and doing it, of course, and just keeping right along. They can work in an empirical fashion, and a lot of times physicists get all frustrated when they can't understand why it's not working, and they have a tendency not to do anything. Then when they get mad and they can't figure out why, they just let it rest. But engineers, they keep looking for a way it works, and if it works, well, they'll go right ahead and do that, whether they understand it or not, and this is fine. By the way, a lot of the technical advances that you have are said to be due to physicists. Really not, even though I'm a physicist, I shouldn't be saying all these things, but really the engineers have done a lot of these things without the help of the physicists, and they've made discoveries of things that work without always understanding why particularly they're working, and they go right ahead and do it. Well, the engineers went right ahead. They calculated table after table, called entropy tables, telling if you had this much energy available, you had a difference in temperature between the heat source and the surroundings, how much you could expect to get out of that, or how much you shouldn't expect to get out of it. And they coined a term called entropy, E-N-T-R-O-P-Y, entropy, which measured the amount that was unavailable in that source. You could know beforehand how much you couldn't get out of that. And entropy was a measure of the amount of that energy that would be unavailable when you went through the process. And they calculated entropy tables all over the place. And nobody ever understood. But they noticed that in all processes, there was this unavailability of energy, or there was a continual measurement of what is referred to as entropy. And even in those days, the engineers were talking about entropy continually increasing in the universe. That every time a process occurred, you were losing, for good, a certain amount of energy that you had right there. Now, you weren't losing this energy from the universe. nobody figures, although in those days the conservation of energy law wasn't even well known or decided by anybody at that time. But yet the engineers were saying the entropy of the Earth, at least, is increasing.